Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This morning, I am lucky to be able to sit down and talk with Jessica Flores, who is a ray of inspiration for me, really. I've enjoyed watching what she does and how she approaches it. I'm in masonry restoration and Jess are in historical preservation. Is that how we put it?
Yeah. Good morning, Al and Jillian. Happy to be with you this morning. Al had said, am I more into historic restoration, preservation? Absolutely. I have a small historic preservation firm called Preservation Forward that I run out of Michigan, but I work all over the state of Michigan and have branched out into Ohio and Indiana, and in my home state of West Virginia.
Does
So
that
happy guys.
take a toll on your traveling? Because from an outsider looking in, you know, I mean, I know that in America, when you say, well, Iowa, these other places, these other states, as if it's nothing. Because I remember when I first got to America, depending on which map you looked at, it might only be about a little quarter of an inch, but that quarter of an inch could mean 100 miles or more. It's not as if, like in England, you're only going out for 6 miles here, 10 miles there. So you must do quite a bit of traveling in the year then.
I do. I get around a little bit. That little quarter inch is probably about 2 to 4 hours. And yeah,
Ha
You know, I get calls about historic building needs, kind of like a wide radius. I've had calls as far as North Dakota and Idaho, Iowa, most recently. But I kind of need, I'm a little bit tethered here to Michigan because one, I have three kids, but also I teach at Michigan State. So in the fall and spring semesters, I'm tethered here a couple days a week, which is I say tether, but really it's a joyful passion of mine as students at Michigan State University. But I do tend to get out. I get calls about buildings and I won't turn a historic building down. So I've been known to say, I can't get to you right now, but I will get to you in 6 weeks, you know, something like that. So
I
if
agree,
you
but I must.
will travel for old buildings should be my bumper sticker.
Yeah, honk if you like old buildings. Dang. So, I mean, you're a young lady. I mean, I know you've got three kids, but how did you get involved in the historic side and the passion for it?
You know, when I was a little kid, I was drugged by my parents to flea markets and yard sales, anything that was free entertainment. I think I shared this once with Jillian that my parents would take us to the historic sites, a lot of nature conservancy places too, anything that was free and get us out and about. I'm one of four children. And so my parents had like a picker side to them. They would pick furniture and stuff off the side of the road, refinish it, repurpose it. Also, my paternal grandparents they're like the OG original. Gangster American pickers. They were always flipping.
I had an English one as well, so yeah, carry on. My
And
granddad was there. Yes.
I think it helped them get the seed. They would show, you know, my dad really loved buildings and architecture. And my paternal grandmother, Lillian, she really loved spaces and would get magazines. She was from the Holler in West Virginia, and she would get like Architectural Digest and all these other magazines that I would look at as a child, and she would point out me. She just had an eye. She didn't belong. Being a child of Appalachia, but she didn't belong in West Virginia. She had a big personality and spirit and a keen eye for design and architecture. And that kind of was passed down to my dad and then passed down to me. And I don't know, from a young child, my parents did Falling Water and other sites. It was free to go back then. I mean, they might have paid a nominal fee to enter those for adults, but kids were free, so they drug us around and I paid attention. And honestly, I think that's where it came from. Kind of a little bit forward from there, when I was 21, I bought a building and opened up the store. I was always around antique. Funny, I'll tell you really quickly here. I told my students this last week. The bedroom that I grew up in was all antique. I had a huge old 1890 Victorian bed I slept in. This is the true story. All growing up, my siblings, three other siblings, had normal beds, but I got the leftovers. And I had a big headboard as high as the ceiling and the footboard. My feet, it was a really short bed, and my feet would hit up against the end of the footboard. I had the
How that
It's a while my feet would be smushed all night, but maybe
goes.
that's I'm short, I'm a small person, and I just had like Victorian pictures and lamps and sconces in this room. room that it was strange. That's the room I wanted to sleep in all the time. I say it happened by osmosis. It kind of just happened for the 18 years that I was in that room. That's strange.
We've all got a story to tell, and it's always entertaining. I mean, especially with most of us in preservation and stuff, we all seem to be a rare odd bunch that we've all got these stories of how it brought us to it. I mean, like mine, I got out the military, was going to go into catering, become a top chef and everything, went and worked in the industry, and then came back after a month and running a big place and realized that wasn't for me. So a friend of mine put me on to masonry and said, "Hey, you should have a go at doing this masonry restoration. It's outside, it'll keep you going." And as well as I must admit, I did have a big spark for Lego and Meccano when I was younger. So I think that was definitely. Hold on, sorry, I'll definitely do that. Turn that down. I had definitely a passion for putting things, taking things apart, putting them back together. And I think that's where I got into it in England, because I started off with normal residential buildings, and then I started getting into the historic. And once I got into the historic, then it was into my blood. It's a bit like you. Once you get into that historic feeling, and people can't understand, and I'm sure you've done it before, Jess. Have you done it before in an old building where you can feel the energy and you've gone up and you've touched the walls because you can feel the energy of the building?
Absolutely. I feel like, and I have mentioned a jillion, and probably you out too in passing at some point, that I feel like I always am looking for building problems, but building pathology problems and how to diagnose building problems, how to solve building problems. But in the process of this is that your energy is from people that constructed the building, the trade people that work on the
Yes,
building, the people
yes.
who live there.
Yep.
And you have to be open to accepting these kind of messages from beyond, if you will. And I don't want to get too woo-woo, but
No, I know where you're coming from on that one. I'm with you all the way. Keep going.
but if I see, kind of going back to the trade people that worked on these buildings, I'm a sucker for a wall cavity that's been opened or that's, somehow cracked so that I can see the components. It's like the guts of the building. I really like to see any kind of nod to how people, what construction methods that they applied in the past. I'm really fascinated by that,
I think that one of the things is that in the UK, we had a set way of design of buildings from the Victorians and things like that. But it's interesting when you come to America. And when I come to America, I said I've done a lot of downtown workshops with the Texas Historical Commission and the Main Street Managers. But one of the things that we found and we see down there is that you'll have a German influence, you'll have a Dutch influence, you'll have an English influence, and you can see the styles of the brickwork coming together and things like this, and the style of the outside, and you think, yeah, the architect had his background where you could tell the feelings, the different ways of putting them together from around the world. And it's quite exciting because, like in Texas, as you know, we got Fredericksburg, which is definitely German, and then even when you go all the way down to Brownsville, to the border, which I did a historic workshop down there for 6.5 hours. But in Brownsville, they spoke five languages. Had Dutch, Portuguese, English, Spanish, and German in its day.
Wow.
That's how many people came over and the different ones. And also, as well, America for me is the downtown squares in Texas when they build a big courthouse and everything else is built around it. It's got that fort mentality. Does it have the same up north as it does down here? Or is it, because that's something I noticed, is it's definitely cowboys and Indians territory down here.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have that same kind of courthouse square laid out here in Michigan. And remember, how land was originally platted. We're taking us another quick a hard right here, real quick, Al. But
Yeah.
I look out, land was surveyed and platted. So up
Right.
here in the north, it's really methodical.
Yep.
It's a system of rods and chains. It would put you to sleep if we went through and talked about it all. But everything's laid out in a grid system mostly, and it's
Yes.
air system, and it is around a courthouse square. So yeah, Michigan, absolutely. But where I'm from, like in West Virginia, it is organically laid out. It's very much different. Very how the settlement occurred near a waterway, and then it all came up organically like that. Similar to like Ireland, Scotland,
Right.
England, there's a lot of Scotch Irish that settled in West Virginia. But that kind of sporadic laying of parceling of land is not methodical. And it's like, go 200 yards and turn right at the mean dog. When you hit the oak tree, go left. That's all.
Yeah. Oh,
is
that's
where
now that sounds like directions in Texas. And
I
from an Englishman's point of view, that can be a bit dire, because in England we go to the top of the street, we turn left or go right. And in Texas, every time I ask for direction, well, it's a bit north, northwest, and a bit east. And if you come off the east side of the square, where the hell is north for
You better be carrying your compass.
Yes, definitely.
So it's a different way approach. So okay, yes, we have town squares, we have hamlets, we have these very early kind of surveying up here. It's organic, and you know, Texas, it might be different. I've spent a little bit of time in Texas, and they have courthouse squares there, but
Yes.
similar to up here. You had reminded me of something. Oh, that I want to mention, make note of. That's important. Is I absolutely love. This is a real treat for me when we can look at the landscape, the built environment, and we can look at buildings or houses, and we can decipher by thinking about who worked on, who constructed the buildings. You can see the evidence of a Dutch barn that's different than a German barn, a banked barn, different than other types of vernacular agricultural buildings. The Finnish that settled, a lot of individuals from Finland and Northern Europe settled in the UP of Michigan. They construct buildings differently with different materials that are available to them in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan versus like Hamtramck, a Polish settled community just outside of Detroit that has it's rooted all in Polish immigrants. So it's very unique to see the architecture. You had mentioned German and Dutch, and what I refer to that as settlement geography, cultural geography. It's
Yes.
really the fabric of different immigrants in the landscape. To me, that really rich and beautiful. And how can I help to shepherd that story on for future generations to come?
From my point of view, I'm sort of trying to look at education. I know you're heavily into education, and a wonderful job that you do, and you keep expanding and getting better at it all the time. Mine is for definitely for masonry restoration, and it's certainly strange for me to come from England and Europe, where we have masonry restoration, yet over here it's still not classified as a trade so much, because we don't have codes. We don't have no specific historic masonry restoration codes in America. We don't have no masonry veneer codes. Agreed, they are changing, and the civil engineers are wanting to change it, and I hopefully hope that they do, because there's certainly a lot of buildings out there that do need repairing. And you up in the hub of where you are, especially industrial areas, you must have a lot of big industrial commercial buildings, and I think that you're starting to get them more towards redoing them out for apartments and living spaces. I think that's the way that a lot of old buildings will go, hopefully, before they tear them down. How are you
I think so.
finding?
Yeah, I definitely see that. I see a lot of thinking kind of about the Grand Rapids area here in Western Michigan, is it was really the hub of furniture making. Still does have furniture making, like Herman Miller, Steelcase, Miller Gold. Now it was Herman Miller for a long time. But that was really the furniture industry here across West Michigan. So they have all of these really great industrial factory buildings that have now been adaptively reused, adaptively repurposed into residential units. And so, and they make for, I always say this is a really clean rehab, it's a really sweet building type for residential because they're open. There's a lot of daylight because of all the windows that a curtain wall that has all of these beautiful industrial metal windows that can allow daylight into a space. And so you can have an internal artery, internal corridor for residential spaces that everyone has access to natural light that's coming into the space. So they're just like a really sweet prototype for it, just makes sense. And I see it as like a copy and paste all across Michigan, Western Michigan, and all around Detroit. I mean, this is really, you know, the hub of manufacturing here for the automotive industry. And one out of every six jobs is related to the auto industry here in Michigan. So there's a tie back always to the automobile, the big three car makers, and all the industrial buildings that are aligned with them. So it's really, it's junior in Michigan. And then advanced down, I mean, we have like Cleveland and Canton and Youngstown going into Pittsburgh and all these Rust Belt cities. There's preservationists that are sprinkled all around these places. People just like myself are trying to spread the good message of historic preservation and turn around the old buildings and be a voice for that. Oh, so, yeah, it's awesome. awesome.
I think that with me, I've been saying about the different types of buildings, and yet they all come with pretty much the same retrofits. We've got lintels, windows, repointing, brickwork, damage, water, age, and it's maintenance. So I suppose from our point of view, it's really hard trying to teach people for maintenance and things on buildings. And if they do, then I think that we'd extend it a lot more. It's certainly going to be an uphill battle, which we already knew. Some, what did I say the other day? It's like beating your head against a brick wall. But with
I'm
people,
betting you know what that feels like now.
yeah, well, I mean, it's good. I mean, I recently did that teaching in Las Vegas with Michael Schuler up there. That was good on, masonry basics and restoration up there. So it is coming across the board a bit more. It needs a lot more, and that's where we're sort of trying to help with the magazine, which you've been in, thank you very much, and the ladies in there with the Masonry Restoration magazine. And I think that was great getting the word out there. Miss Gillian, the undersung hero here, say she doesn't say a lot but smiles a lot and does a lot. But it certainly is coming together, and that's why I'm really enjoying talking with you, because I think that it's down in Texas. I'm trying to do my bit, you're just trying to do yours up north, and hopefully it'll become nationwide at one point for more restoration and historic preservation. I know that they say, oh well, we've got the different preservation historic organizations, but it'd be nice if they all work together and shared a lot more information and shared the word. Thank
I
you.
think there could be a little bit more synergy between like APD, the Association of Preservation Technology, the NICPE, National Council for Preservation Education. We have several different and trades group and education groups that are based in academia that could do more weaving together their programming. And certainly I try to be a voice for women in the trades and bringing some of our trade schools, promoting of them. I often share with my students at Michigan State saying that are really based in interior design and some construction management, urban planners, is that once you've completed your time here at Michigan State, consider also going and getting a trades degree. Because if you're going to be working around building spaces, there's something to be said about actually having used your hands and the experiential learning opportunities when you're working on buildings and working within places, and you're getting to know kind of the nomenclature of the trades. I think that it's great to go and complete your 4-year degree, but it's really nice to also have it paired with a hands-on background. I mean, I'm just sharing that there's some folks that do that, is share both. You can speak to the contractors that are working on your project and also work with some of the education or governmental organizations that are also part of your project or the work that you're doing. I think it's good to have a hand in both, right?
Do you find it hard to get good restoration men up north? Because it's hard to find them down south. I know that we've got good masons, don't get me wrong. Bricklayers are great at what they do, but restoration is a totally different field, and it takes a lot of skill set and knowledge and experience, and it's hard to put that in. So I think what I'm trying to say is that I see a lot of these experts, so-called, on places like, let me think, oh, Angie's List and people like that. And they've come with about these strange references. Oh yeah, Mrs. Smith or wherever says that we're fantastic. But when you ask them about actual training, have you had any involvement in training? Oh yeah, we fix a lot of things, but they don't say specifically that they trained in this. Or there are no training schools, is what concerns me. And people like Angie's List can really mess up a good building if they don't know what they're doing. And that's why I'm sort of a bit worried about the future in training, because we definitely need experience and we need some training schools. And it'll be interesting to see how we go in the future with that.
There are about two, maybe under a dozen trade schools that specialize in the preservation trades that I kind of kept track of these schools around the country that specialize in the traditional building construction method, mortise and tenon framing, traditional carpentry methods, roofing, masonry, all the appropriate kind of doing the right kind of joints for the historic property, all of your masonry technique and how to assess the structure. So there's probably about a dozen of these schools around America, and I feel like no, this is either you intentionally go to these schools to really learn, you're not part of, and like in my case, I wasn't part of the trades. My parents weren't in a trade. My grandfather worked on the railroad, my dad was a coal miner, and so I didn't have something, this knowledge passed down to me. I had to intentionally go to school to do it. I'm not one of the lucky ones, I say, that had a family business that was passed down generation to generation, this craft, this trade. I didn't have that. So if you don't have that, then you have to go to trade school. And it's a limited number around the country. But if you do have someone that passed it down, it's honestly like, it's really I want to say, not a trade secret, but it's something that you should cherish and pass on. This is something that lands to the next generation. But the people that have been doing the preservation trade are dying. So we need to pass that down. And I don't know if that torch is being passed or not. That's something that I think about a lot. We have craftspeople up here in the north. I'm blessed to be really connected with a good group of preservation individuals in a really small knit preservation circle here in Michigan and in Ohio and West Virginia, which is smaller than Michigan. Preservation circle is that really need to get connected. And then once you get into the fold of, who's the right plasterer to go to, who's the right architect that understands historic building construction, and how to treat historic building materials, maybe pair them with new building technology. You really have to keep them kind of in your pocket so that you know who to call on. There's only three masons that I call in Michigan on my project.
That
That
sounds good. It's a very tight niche in what we work in. And also as well, I mean, I'm a member of the Masonry Society. I've sat on the existing for 15, 17 years, where I've met some wonderful people. But one thing I have learned in Texas is there's some great engineers, phenomenal engineers, but there's a limited amount of engineers that deal with historic buildings. And it's hard to get that working relationship to save the older buildings. I mean, Jamie Crowley of the Texas Historical Commission, their side of it and their team are wonderful. We've worked alongside them, very open to letting us try and help the Main Street program people and things like that. And it is hard because there's certainly for us down here to try and educate on the historical side. It's hard work because a lot of old towns certainly don't have the will, the money, the knowledge to want to push to fix the downtown. Certain economic development can change in the fact that we were discussing this morning. There's an old town further out up the road from us, and it's called Honeygrove. And what it was in the old days, the people that were on the way down to the Alamo stopped there before they went down there. And it's old Honeygrove, a beautiful old German style town in itself, but it's now had a road go past it for about 15 years, a bypass, and it's just killed that small town. And one of the things is in Texas is certainly a lot of rural areas are hard to get to with the infrastructure and things like that. So that's a bit different out here, trying to get to these small towns that we can work on. But there's plenty of them. There's plenty of small towns down here that need it. And for me, it's definitely, I realize you're not in Kansas anymore a lot of times when I'm down there. And it's quite amazing, really, to get involved with these old towns, things like that, in down here in Texas. So I'm sure up north, you must be the same. You must find some little enclaves that you just must fall in love with, same as me.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I think kind of going back to your comment about interstate or the highway being put on the periphery of a community and what happens, it's disjointed, right? It becomes fractured. You need to get people back into the heart of your community, which is a traditional downtown, the areas that we love, right? Then we're
Yes.
kind of on to where all the historic turn of the century buildings are constructed. But a lot of highways, when they were put in the late 1950s for the highway, the Transportation Act, they bypassed our community. So now we need to give people a reason to come off of the highway, get into your community. And this is really where preservation and urban planning marry well together, is we need in our civil engineers, our transportation planners to say, wait a minute, let's be more concerned about pedestrians rather than vehicles. We want to get people into our communities, want to like watch curb kind of all of this is going into a little wormhole out. Maybe we don't want to go in, but we want to curb all the dependency on cars. We want more people in our downtowns, more walkable communities, safe, well-lit communities, and really embracing the historic architecture. We need the trade people to be able to work on the building to make them unique and vibrant and reactivate storefront spaces. I mean, this is all the language and kind of the rhythm that I breathe all day long, is getting people in the communities in the old building, reactivating spaces, working with trade people like yourself, masons, expert masons, to do the brickwork, the rehabilitation that we need to get people to come off of the highway and patronize our community again. And I think people want that experience. I talk to my students that are, very early 20s, 20, 21, and they all really want experience. So they don't want to just be out in a suburban sprawl area. They want to get kind of the authenticity of a community. So I refer to it as place keeping, keeping a place, keeping it nice, taking care of it, nurturing it, caring for it for the next generation. The term was kind of like a decade or so ago, place making. I kind of push back on that because I think we already have a place. We don't need to make one, but we're keeping it. We're keeping the place at night. So aesthetically pleasing. But it takes the tradespeople. So going back to what you had said, what do we do? Well, we get more shop classes in high schools. We get more exposure to the trade. We get young people understanding. Like I have a sophomore in high school. She is college is not the first thing she's thinking of. I want her to come work with her mama, which she right now has a disdain for historic buildings. She's 16 and has her own ideas, almost 16 has her own ideas, but I'm a huge advocate of her going into the trade. I just did a search yesterday. I was looking for the highest paid trade job for a female. What do you think it is?
Plumber.
That was the third. Honest to goodness, what do you think the first is?
Let me think. Plumber, electrician.
You hit it. Yeah, electrician. There are not a lot of female electricians. If my daughter says, this is what I want to do, I'll absolutely encourage her to do that. And you all know I'm going to make her try to come and work with Preservation Forward and work on my home.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because one of the things that I've said out here is that I'm in the wrong game. I should have come back as a plumber. I'd have been a multimillionaire. Oh, electrician. But when people say, what do you do? And I go, masonry restoration. And they go, what's that? Hey, I tell you, and people always say to me, so is it a trade I should go in? And I remember telling this guy, I said, no. He said, why not? I says, well, you'll always be broker than a joke. He said, what do you mean broker than a joke? I'm telling you, mate, it's not something to say. It's funny because when Pete, as an example, I said to a customer phoned me up and said, will you come out and give us a bid on my job? And I thought, man, it's an hour away. I said, to tell you what, I'll charge you $50 for me to come out, cover my fuel and time and have a meeting with you. Quote, person said, how much? I said, $50. So they said, well, the other three people ain't charging that.
Yeah.
Well, fair enough then. But if you had a drippy tap or you had a funky switch, they'd want you out there and they don't mind paying for it. And it's funny how you can talk about different trades and how they're perceived in that light. But yeah, definitely, you're right about with women, because one thing I like about women in the trades, they're certainly more attention detail.
Meticulous,
Yes,
absolutely. I say they are.
yes. There's a lot of men out there who say, oh, we know this, this, and the other. But I think that one thing I've noticed about working with a lot of women is, first of all, if you're not scared of a woman, you're stupid. Second is that they're certainly the wiser of the bunch. They've got more patience. They've got more patience to sit down and pay attention to that detail, I think, well. So yes, plumbers, electricians, things like that. It'd be nice to see the different trades, and it'd be nice to see them coming into the trades as well. As for the teaching of historic preservation, the way that you're doing there, because there's not a lot of people like you out there that's teaching in that respect. You get the colleges in, but not with the passion that you do. And I hope that we find a lot more other people with the same passion that can certainly push it the way you do. You love historic buildings, same as me. And like Gillian, you've become part of it. Gillian was a part of it in churches, things. So there's a lot of buildings out there that do need it. Because when everybody says about masonry restoration, they always think that it's just fixing a brick. But it's not, it's the building, it's a part of it, it's the community, it's everything. Saving them buildings are important. And especially for the downtown, main streets, things like that. But it's
If
hard.
we don't have our history, what do we have? If we don't have how the story of our place and those
Thank
who
you.
place, what do we have? I mean, that's my purpose. I really feel like I was put here to help people with their buildings. Honestly, the basis of what I want to do is just help other people. It just happens to be my medium is historic buildings. I understand the component, the makeup of a building. I understand the complexities, how they're put together. That I just know a lot about a teeny tiny subject. Everything else, I'm like a child. I'm always learning. I'm a life learner, student here. But I love to share that. That's my purpose, Alan Jillian, is just helping people with buildings. I mean, I wish it could have been something. I would love to be a painter or a sculptor or
I
I
know where
would
you're
love
coming
business,
from. I know where you're coming from exactly. With
but this is all I
the
got. I mean, I cook a little bit. I cook kind of good, but I'm not going to be able to make a livelihood out of it. But I know building, and I love love being a woman in the trades and working with my trade people on my project around Michigan and in Ohio and West Virginia. It's just that I love to be some more often than not, I'm the only woman on the job
Are
site.
you, do you do a lot? Is it mainly commercial or do you do small residential and things? Because I do a lot of small residential. I was on one 1890 house
Oh, yeah.
with five big chimneys, and I find them fascinating. For one, that they're still standing and the design and things like that. But it certainly, as you said, it brings so much character. And a lot of these small areas, small towns, are working on keeping these together. But one of the big things, as you and I well know, that the hardest thing is that when people talk about preservation, they don't realize that you can't walk into Home Depot and say, "Can I have 100-year-old, two pallets of 100-year-old bricks that look like this?" It's not
Exactly.
happening. It's not happening because one of the things is for us as well in preservation, we're always trying to match the materials, find them. So we're always like the borrowers. We're always trying to take from one and put to another and adapt. And it's funny because when we talk about masonry restoration and preservation, the two different things. One is a patch, can be a light patchwork to try and keep water out. The other can be a full dismantle and put it back together. One of the things that worries me about all the historic buildings in Texas is the mercantile buildings, because the thing is that they're two-story buildings with this big, great, beautiful facade on the outside, which normally has corbelled brickwork hanging up, so it's naturally starting to rotate over the years forward, but nobody inspects it. So one of the things that I came up with was a friend of mine came over from Ireland, and we were drinking a few beers, and he said to me, "You know the problem with America downtown squares?" I said, "What's that?" He said, "You don't have double-decker buses." "What the hell do you mean double-decker buses?" He said, "Well, listen, Al, do you remember when we was younger and we were coming back home from work and you'd get on a double-decker bus and you'd go straight upstairs to the top? When it was driving down the street and it stopped on a two-story building and you looked out, you didn't have to be an engineer to say there's a problem." So I said,
That
"Well," he says, "look, you think about it. You've got Google Earth, and Google Earth will drive around the street view, and you can look and you can see it. But nobody's done a two-story view." And that's why I
was
was going to
smart.
ask you one of the questions. Over the last couple of years, one of the questions I asked at the World of Concrete was how many people use drones? And I was expecting everybody to put the hand up. There was four, just four people out the whole crew. And I still can't find it hard to believe that drones are not being used enough. Because for me, I think that especially with buildings on the downtown square, if the building inspectors could fly a drone and fly it around and use some of the software, they'd know if they had a problem with the building. Because
Absolutely. No, go
nobody
ahead.
looks up. Nobody looks up.
Now, all of my projects, so photography, we refer to it in preservation world, photo documentation. So we photograph existing condition. And absolutely, a drone is utilized to get that, the roof, to see what's going on with the roof, the parapet, the chimney. There's water coming in. Where's the flashing deteriorated? Just every, all the, how does the masonry, pardon me, if it's a, all the idiosyncrasies of a historic building, we absolutely must have a top-down view. And that's the introduction of drone photography into photo documentation. When we're looking and assessing, evaluating historic buildings. It's critical, very important. So, and you can just do a lot of manipulating with drones and getting good video, videography and close-up images on mortar joints and tensile cracks and all those things that we really look closely at in our historic building. Al, you had asked me, what do I predominantly work on in residential or commercial? Well, both actually, but my projects are all mixed use. My kind of portfolio of projects that I have working on right now are all, almost all of them are, have a commercial storefront and residential units on the above floors. I do have a couple of apartment buildings I'm working on that are all residential. One was always an apartment building being adapted into, being renovated, restored into with contemporary finishes, a historic building in the Milwaukee Junction neighborhood in Detroit. I also, my oldest project that I'm working on right now, I'm really proud of this one. This is a new one. Is an 1873 jail with a sheriff's residence, and that in big, isn't it wild? The sheriff's
But
jail.
I can feel you with the energy in that one, definitely.
It has original jail cells,
Oh.
1873. It's a Queen Anne. There's only three, I believe, in Michigan, and this is one of, and it's in Big Rapids, which is where Ferris State University is. It's about 2 hours from the Lansing area here. It's on the northwest side of the state, and I'm really pleased and honored to work on this one. It has been minimally modified. The exterior, it retains all its original. It has a turret. It's really beautiful. If I have a picture, I'll show, or I'll share one with you. But it was a kit house, so it being the original jail and the sheriff's residences there. It had a later small addition in the 1890s of a kit that they would put on. This was something you could order, a jailhouse kit to be attached to the building. It's wild. Got
Well,
a lot of
now
stories.
then, now then, that's funny you should say that about with the kit, because one thing that I didn't realize about America and mercantile buildings was that you could buy all of it came in a kit. So
Catalog, yeah.
you got the I-beams, you got the front stanchions, you got the corniche, everything. You ordered it from a catalog online, and it was delivered to you in Texas. It might get there by horse or by car, and then what you did is you got a local mason to build up the brickwork around this facade and build it back up. But one thing that I will talk about is that you're same as me. One thing in America that you cannot find, and it sets us back so much, you can never find the original drawings.
It's often hard. I have the original blueprint of this one.
There you
This was
go. Now that it's like a treasure trove, isn't it? It's just unreal because you finally find out. Okay, there you go. I did one 1860 and up here, and I found the original architect's spec. And on the bottom, it had 2 foot by 8 foot cut stone was the foundations in pieces put down, and then the brick putting built on top of that to come back up after that. It was amazing reading it, but a lot of times when we get down to these old buildings, there's nothing we really find. But it was funny, wasn't it? Because there was another one that you said is sometimes when we see cracks in buildings, old buildings, and you can see inside. You're like me though. When we get in some of these old buildings and we find an old 1890s paper, newspaper, and you sat reading it, and we used to do the same in England because I used to work on Edwardian, Victorian, Tudor buildings. In fact, the oldest building I worked on is 2,000 years old, built by the Romans, York Wall in England.
Oh my word.
There you go.
You got it. You've been working on them longer than I have, Al.
I tell you what, Edwardian, Victoria, Tudor.
Oldies. You know, it's so funny. I soak all that up because I really love to hear about what people are working on and what they're up to, what they're doing, how old dated the structure is. I have a friend, I must be like the repository of all things old, because my buddy Tom in Grand Rapids was coming through to go to Detroit, and he met me and said, "I have something for you, Jess." And he brought me original prints from a building in Toledo. I'm not working on it, but Tom said I needed it. All right. But the plans are on linen. Have you ever seen plans on linen?
Oh no.
Really stunning. I'm going to get them framed and hang them up. It's a
Oh, I
historic
bet
building in
you.
downtown Toledo in Ohio, here about an hour and a half, about 2 hours from me, south of me. And they're on linen. They're gorgeous. The ink, the pen on the linen, they're really beautiful. And I feel really lucky that he wanted to share those with me. He was downsizing and he figured I'd want them, and he was right. But an artistry to me is all those original and the details and the architectural, you know, like a cut sheet or a detailed image of a molding or a bracket, a cornice of a pair of a pilaster, pilaster. I sometimes, you know, when you're looking at these really beautiful detailed elevations, like if you've ever looked closely at like a historic American building survey, that's detailed. The Library of Congress holds the historic American building surveys for a variety of buildings across the country. They are like artwork, honestly, where you have it, Google Habs, HABS, Historic American Building Survey, and it will show you all the elevation builds. And I don't know if they were on linen or not originally.
I went in, I was when I was in Brownville, I went in an old church, and at the top of it looked as though it had been screeded in like purpley, beautiful, like blue. It was blue ceiling. And what it was fabric that they'd done on the inside of the church to make it all out across top. And it was spectacular inside. I like old churches. You must have a lot of old churches up and around you.
A lot of old churches and a lot of like Gothic revival.
Yes.
So we have, you know, a lot of revival style churches here. You'll see that a lot. lot. Warren, Michigan. We have one, a couple in downtown Lansing, Grand Rapids, all over, a lot in Detroit. But that was, the style, thinking about the early 1900s in England, part of the British Industrial Revolution. A lot of Victorian referred to those buildings as the Gothic Revival. And that came by way when people were coming, immigrating to America. They brought these revival styles coming out of the British Industrial Revolution, bringing them here to America. That spread like a seed across different parts of, the eastern portion of our country. And then when we're coming down through like now in Michigan, all these really cool Northern New York styles and New England styles came into Michigan that way, came in from the north. I really love cultural geography, Al. Am I
I
putting you to
do. I do. I think it's amazing. And one of the things that you don't find anymore is old stonemasons that used to do the carvings and things. But it's very, very interesting watching the CNC and things machines now that can redo a lot of this work. Some of the things that I've been sort of toying over in my head is that when we're talking about old bricks, and you up north have the same problem, I'm waiting for someone to bring out a CNC machine that can then color code it across the top. Like when you go to Home Depot and you can get a paint spot and say, hey, can you match this color? I'm waiting for one day that they can match the bricks.
I got something for you.
Go
Have
ahead.
you ever looked at a Sanborn fire insurance map?
No.
Oh, I'm gonna open up your world, Al,
Oh
here.
yeah, I love welding open. Oh, there's another one that I wanted to talk with you and ask your opinion. Now, as an interest, sorry, go on.
It's just that they color code building materials on fire insurance maps from the 18 started in, I think, 1873, went up through the 1930s, I believe. And
Wow.
it's all kinds of different downtowns and communities across America, but
Yeah.
plenty Texas and plenty in Michigan. And you can look at how they used to for fire rating, and they ha would have how the what kind of masonry was used, and the dimensions of the building, materials for the building, sometimes owner use. They're beautiful to look at. You will love that. I'll
Yeah,
send it to
I think that as well as is that I'm looking forward to down the line being a part of the change on the codes because America certainly needs to be a bit more aware of preservation and that it can be done. And it needs to change codes that the buildings are inspected a bit more and definitely being able to give us some guidelines because I think that's what's lacking in America right now. Its infrastructure itself is certainly needing a lot of repair. And I'm looking forward to hopefully being a part of that revitalized movement, same as yourself and a few others with the Masonry Society, the APTI. And as you said, there is a lot of great organizations out there, and it's going to take time and effort. It's going to take a team. But I think that as long as there's people like you, me, and other people that are passionate about this, we're going to make a change. We are. And as I said, me and Jill at the moment, we're certainly trying to push the Masonry Restoration magazine, and we think that that's a good way of trying to get to people and inform them. I like the way that, as you've expressed, that there's women certainly within the industry coming in, and that's making a change. And I think that for me, doing the last magazine with all women in it was great for me to get feedback. Well, Gillian, you did all the work, a lot of work all on that, and yes, you helped with a lot of feedback and things. But it was interesting to see the ladies and their thoughts and things like that, like Kendra with the architect, and Davis with the engineer, and even Tiffany Telema, from a bricklayer. We're still talking. We're working on trying to get on a old historic project together on a museum. So that'll be interesting. And she's great for feedback. She's got great feedback. She's got great passion. And I think that's that a lot of the ladies out there do. They do, and they shine at it. So I want to be a part of that down the line, that we all get together and make a change. And I think it's coming.
I think so too. I've got to tell you both, I'm really honored to have been included in that list of women in masonry. It was a real pleasure and a joy of mine listed or alongside those women. So thank you for having me. And I'd love to do more, just having like a more an open dialogue discussion, kind of like what we're having here today of just women in the trades and everybody kind of sharing, here's what I'm experiencing, here's what really kind of firsthand what I'm experiencing in the field. I think that would be an awesome podcast, Jillian, of getting a little bit of feedback from our women in the trades and things, challenges that they're facing, successes that they can share to pass on to other, younger, new women that are coming into the preservation trade, the building trades. I think that would be an awesome podcast as well, maybe in the future. But I wanted to circle back really quickly on the rehab. You had mentioned the building code in Michigan, and some of the other states that I'm working in, is we always follow rehab code, which is not very robust for historic preservation. Asian historic building, adaptive reuse and whatnot. But you know, that we need something that is specifically tailored to historic buildings. There's flexibility, you know, we need to have ADA compliant, need to have universal design, need to have adequate insulation in our building. Just kind of picking out things that are coming to mind, but we need to have them appropriately though, administered in historic building following a code that is favorable for historic preservation. Historic preservation is not slighted in the rehab code, but I don't feel like it's robust enough. I don't feel like it addresses things like renewable energy technology on work building, which is a side passion of mine, sustainability and energy efficiency in a more sustainable construction approach. You know, I'm not a big fan. People say, Jessica, you hate new construction. Well, that's not true. I'd like to take care and nurture and adapt what we have existing before we're building more. Don't we have enough right now? Don't we need to modify what we have existing? Keep all those materials, construction and demolition waste out of our landfills. I just come from, like, honestly, probably a Depression era philosophy. We need to use up what we have before we build more.
Well, it's funny you should say that. I was looking at, I'm into robotics. I always have been into robotics. I think that it's a good way. One of the things I was looking at, and I was having a beer with an engineer, and he said about, because I think it was an architect, Jamie Crowley, who said there's no better carbon footprint than the one existing. And I thought, yeah, you're right on that. But here's the point. A lot of times when you said about buildings knocked down and they end up in a landfill, I wanted to invent a robot that could go down and just dismantle the bricks and put them clean onto a pallet and take them somewhere else and reuse them bricks. That to me would be a much better idea than just filling landfills, and you can use the secondary bricks on the inside and reuse them again. You think of all the bricks that would be there, there'd be millions, millions.
That's where we get all of our bricks for projects. It's from the brickyard, from masons that have just collected brick over years, and you go to their repository of leftover brick and you find all these different variety, variegated bricks that you can use on different projects. That's where I get my brick. I mean, that's where we go to a salvage yard of brick. I have to put a nod out or a shout out to my friends at the City of Antonio Historic Preservation Office, because they are really leading the trend in what we refer to as deconstruction. Deconstructing. Sometimes buildings have to be taken down, or they have achieved their lifespan. They have completed their lifespan. That happens, and it can't be repurposed. We dismantle, we gently deconstruct. In the city, the Historic Preservation Office coming out of the City of San Antonio is doing really great research and advocacy and awareness for this new approach that has some preservationists a little bit off kilter, which I say I'm kind of like an evolve. If we can't retain the building, which our absolute last thing is demolition, the last approach is demolition. But if we have to demolish, we don't demolish. We curb the landfill, and we go to dismantling construction, clean the brick, clean the material so they can be put to use in the new
Well,
project.
not just bricks, it's the fireplaces, it's the joists. You can't, the wood they used in building in the old days are still stronger and better than most of the stuff you can buy now.
Yes, that'll like sapwood, the old
Yeah.
timber, really
Yeah, the
hard.
big 2x12s and things like that. I mean, they're spanned right across and are still good to this day. We
It's a
still
very, yeah, sorry, now I'm getting excited out.
Yeah, but it's true, isn't it? And there's a lot of them, and a lot of materials in these buildings end up on landfill, and they really shouldn't. I mean, we talk, as we said, especially in these old historic places. If you've been in an old big Victorian house and it's got five chimneys and five big fireplaces, some of those fireplaces, you just couldn't replace them anymore. And also, as well, the wooden floors. Some of the wooden floors, oh man, I've seen some beautiful ones. And
The really tight tree ring, the tight
yeah.
growth, you know, quarter sawn oak, and it's really
Well,
tall.
one of the things I enjoyed doing with the Texas Historical Commission was that I've seen different buildings changed into different uses. So an old fire station was changed into these cool offices, a vintage fire station and things like this. And it still keeps that character inside. And when you go in the building, you're like, whoa. And it draws you to it. And you, Gillian, was talking one time up at Landown, where you are, the old theatre.
Oh, yes.
The story of the theatre, of how they put the money into it to build it back up and get it restored and get it back into its former glory. And when they do, you find that a lot of the people in the city really take pride in seeing it how it was and how it should be, because it's still there but been reused. And I think that's why I'm really glad that you're out there and pushing this. And I look forward, as I said, for us talking further down the line, because Texas, to me, I got involved in Fort Stockton, home of the Buffalo Soldiers. soldier. I went down on the museum down there. Talk about cowboys and Indians. I mean, I like West Texas. It's different from here. And as I said, I ain't from around these here parts. But seeing all these older buildings and different styles and adapting to them, you don't think about how much difference, like you, if you thought about it, the size of from where you are to me right now, if that was Europe, we'd be covering most of bloody Europe.
I know,
yeah. You've got different styles of buildings up there as you have down here in Texas. And it's funny because when I grew up, my grandma and granddad, especially my granddad, was into the cowboy and western movies. Never did I think I'd be a part of it.
Explains the hat.
Very proud now, Al. You know, the climates are different. So the materials are different. The approach,
yes.
The building techniques are different.
Yes.
And that is, that's really where the beauty lies and all the details of how, you know, everything's local. The local materials are different than in Michigan. The climate different here than in South Texas. And so we build differently. You might have a large veranda, or you might be making the stucco Spanish colonial style building, but you want to make it cool and ventilated. You know, in Louisiana, they build a lot of their structures on stilts. They're all raised, elevated to get ventilation through the house. Plus, it's swampy, so it's wet. So keeping moisture off of the house and on stilts is a different technique. We don't do that up here in Michigan. We do other techniques to keep the house warm, things like that, to keep enhanced daylight coming into a building, keeping it warm in the winter months. And we do our tricks for keeping it cool in the summer months. But down in like the South Carolina, North Carolina, kind of low country area, the kitchens are outside. They didn't traditionally have kitchens inside. So all those idiosyncrasies I love. I think that it's vernacular architecture, just the architecture of the everyday person I'm really interested in. You know, I appreciate high style architecture, but I really like just vernacular, like old architecture too. We could talk for a long time now. You know
that.
Oh,
come on. We talk for days, and especially I'm lucky I've got Jillian every day. So I mean, you know, we bounce off each other and stuff like that. And you're right, we talk about it because we have passion for it, but we also understand that we need to do something about it as a team long term. A lot of people, it's going to take a lot of people to get it in the right direction. But when it does, yourself, me, Jillian, and other people around, we're willing to share that knowledge with people to try and help. And that's why I said with the magazine, with the podcasts, with talking, trying to educate, I'm all for it. And I think that it's going to be fun. And it is fun, actually. I mean, for me, 99.9% of it's enthusiasm. The rest is getting out of bed, right? So we certainly have the passion and the enthusiasm. And I think that the people that are in historic restoration, preservation, and things like that, we were born under a different mold, but we're all in the same way anyway. When you meet people that are into preservation, historic restoration, and, or churches or things and different, they've all got that little, yes, we want to keep the history, because I'm a big advocate for it. I mean, I'm American now. Yeah, you can tell by my voice, a foreign exchange student, but I really enjoy being in America, and I take pride of the old historic buildings, and when I see them and they look beautiful, it's amazing, because that is America. I love the history. And when you dig deeper and dig into the buildings, how they were built, and it's funny because me and Jill were doing a deep search into Texas, how the small towns started and how they increased in size and everything, and the different styles of buildings coming into it. But one thing that scares me about the insurance companies down the line is that at the moment the insurance companies are looking at roofs and saying that if you don't have your roof fixed, we're gonna not insure you anymore. And that's why I'm worried about historic buildings, because they're gonna say if you don't maintain them, we ain't gonna insure you anymore. So I think that might be an incentive to the owners, because a lot of owners that just abandon the buildings, like we was in Caddo, the owner won't let anybody touch it. It's falling down. The front is just hanging. It's just falling. But nobody does anything about it. Just put a fence around it. Stay away from it.
That's where the city needs to exercise their dangerous building ordinance. And I do help communities
with that. That's what I'm saying.
Is how you enact in absentee owners that are not caring for their buildings. There's such thing as ordinances, dangerous building ordinances, that they can exercise a little muscle in to get people to make the repairs so that the public safety and welfare is not at stake.
Yes, it changes changes from state to state, and it's interesting to see, even from county, it depends how much money they've got in it. So
a building inspector would be able to tag that building and then put a, put how long this violation until they turn it around. So that's something to think about for that community in particular in Oklahoma. You know, it's some are tighter, some are more regulatory communities than others. Some are a little bit looser with personal property rights. It just depends on kind of the political, the ethics of the community and the preservation ethos. That's another podcast.
Well, it's funny. it certainly is. And we'll cover that down the line. But one of the things that I learned in Texas was that my building's covered under the grandfather clause. Huh? How'd you work that out? I've got a granddad, he's dead. Sorry, but I mean, building can only last so long. Oh no, it's covered under grand. So they've got this illusion that it's okay, we can leave it as long as we want. But I think that more, as you said, public safety is becoming more paramount, which it should be always. And I think that that is going to help make change, especially down in Texas, and I'm sure it up in your neck of the woods. So we'll see where it all pans out. But I tell you what, girl, I can't thank you enough for coming on this morning and having a chit chat. And I know that in the future we'll be having other chit chats. I always enjoy talking to you, me and Jillian. I'm looking forward to the magazine down the line, and I'm looking forward to learning from you, as I always do, Jess. And keep up the good work and keep the passion going. And we'll be talking soon, I hope. But thank you very much for coming on and having a chat. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you both for taking time out of your day to hear a little bit of enjoyment around preservation and turning around old buildings. It's a pleasure to talk with you both, and thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jess.